This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, this is Dan Levitard. Welcome to South Beach Sessions. This is not a political podcast. We are talking to a newsman, an old-fashioned newsman from CNN, Jake Tapper, and Mike Ryan has been riding me because he says that I was too harsh on Jake Tapper, that I bullied him a little bit at the start of this.
It comes off overly critical, and I know you were doing kind of a bit, but do you know Jake Tapper at all?
I was presumptuous in calling him a failure, but perhaps we can find out together how cringeworthy this is. I did take my foot off the gas.
Yeah, you had to, because there was 10 uncomfortable minutes that I had to suffer through an edit.
10?
Yeah.
10 uncomfortable minutes?
Yeah, I thought you went way back with Jake Tapper, but towards the end it was evident that that was your first ever time talking to Jake Tapper.
I tend to do that
oddly
sometimes.
Oddly comfortable with Jake Tapper. Did you think he knew who you were, or...
Let's listen together.
Like, what was the banter beforehand? Like, who treats someone this way?
Let's get to know Jake Tapper a little bit and see how graceful he is under pressure when I'm an asshole. My first question, Jake, is who has, and thank you for joining us, the best parking spot or office? You, Anderson Cooper, Wolf Blitzer, how does the hierarchy work there in terms of the best accents that the powerful people there have?
Well, I'm in D.C., so I can only really compare my parking spot to that of other D.C. people. I don't know what Anderson has up in New York. Anderson always has better than me. I would imagine Anderson has his own helipad on top of the building, for all I know, or a bat tunnel from his manse in downtown New York. But in D.C., I would say that Wolf and John King and Breonna Keeler and Pamela Brown and I, who are the, and Jim Acosta, we all pretty much have the same level of parking.
Okay. So it's not something you sit around. You don't like, it's not office politics, none of that stuff. You're a team. You're not paying attention to that stuff. That stuff Blitzer cares about, but not necessarily you. That stuff,
or Dana Bash. No, I don't care if Dana Bash has a better parking space than me. I just want to make sure I have a parking space.
I find your biography very interesting, Jake, because it seems like the career you've chosen, because you're here to talk to us about your latest novel, The Devil May Dance, but you seem to have a real artist in there. And this profession is not for the artists. This is the profession for the straight-laced. And so do I have this wrong? If you're tackling on the side the writing of a novel, you must be trying to feed stuff that the job's not feeding you.
I think it is fair to say that I aspire to have a creative side that doesn't necessarily always get to be exercised through my work in news, which is appropriate. I shouldn't be bringing fictitious ideas and fanciful ideas to a news program. But yeah, no, I had a comic strip in my college paper, and then after college, I went to film school for a semester, and I mean, I've written nonfiction, and obviously that's my job during the day. But yeah, no, I'm a big consumer of fiction. I don't go home and watch news. I go home and watch, like last night, I watched Dope Sick. I watched one of the episodes of Dope Sick, which is really, really good.
So you failed.
failed at what? I mean, I love news also. I love them both. I mean, I guess I could be a screenwriter or a novel writer, and that's my primary job, and then I could be doing news on the side, but I don't know how I could do that. I don't know. There's no real news on the side thing.
I'm just going back to whatever it is you imagined you would be in high school and college and when you were thinking about what it is that you were going to feed. Because if you've got a book in you, and especially this kind of book, like, Jake, this is a challenge. You're somebody who clearly is looking for things that are either hard or fill your soul with something else. If in your spare time, the job that you have isn't consuming you enough to scratch all the itches, like this is a Herculean effort to sit down and tackle this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a failed cartoonist. I wanted to be a cartoonist after college, a comic strip cartoonist, and I definitely failed at that. I don't think that I thought I wanted to be a novelist at the time. I did go to film school for a semester, so I guess I didn't succeed in that either. But, I mean, I could quit the job in news and just do novels. I mean, they're successful enough that I'm being paid to do them, but I would take a huge financial hit. So it's probably just better for me to keep doing the news thing, which is, you know, it's really, really tough to be a rich novelist. I mean, you really have to be like Daniel Silva or John Grisham, or, I mean, you have to sell millions of books and not tens of thousands. You have to sell millions of books. And so, but the truth is though, I'm a news junkie. So I love my news job. I mean, it's just enjoyable. I guess I would just be sitting at home watching the news if I were a full-time novelist. And, you know, so I guess there are two itches, and I'm lucky actually that I get to scratch them both, kind of.
How early or when did you decide that newsman was the path?
It wasn't even that direct a decision. It was more after college, I went to film school. I didn't know what I wanted to do, except I didn't want to do that. I spent time at University of Southern California, and it was during the Clarence Thomas hearings, and I would be sitting in class listening to the Clarence Thomas hearings. And then I went back home and I didn't know what to do. I was 22. A friend of the family started running for Congress. I worked for her. I mean, it just was just like just banging around. Eventually, I was doing public relations for a PR firm in D.C. and miserable and horrible at it. Just awful. And I was on a ski trip with some friends and somebody had a copy of the New Republic. And a guy named, I think his name was Josh Previn. He and his brother had written a story for the New Republic. And it was like a light bulb going off that, like, wait a minute, just like people can write stories for magazines. Just like, you don't have to like work for that magazine full time. You can just submit something. And that was when I kind of thought about freelance writing. And then from there, I did freelance writing for years, and then Washington City Paper, and then Salon.com, and then ultimately ABC News, and it kind of just like banged around, but it was a development of an idea. It wasn't, oh, I want to be an anchorman. It wasn't like that. It was like, oh, I like freelance writing. Oh, I like journalism. And then the kind of the opportunities led me to where I am. I'm probably not unlike you, I would think. It's not like this was your goal, but opportunities presented themselves and then you followed them to where you felt good, right?
But the reason I find your journey interesting is because I think you're a creative trapped within the rigidities. And you may love, like you said, you love the news game, but that particular job is not cartooning. It is not writing. There's writing in it. And you can do excellent reported work and you do excellent work. But it seems to me like you've got something inside you wanting to be fed that this particular industry isn't very good at feeding. I, at least in sports, can fool around. In sports, right. I don't have to be like, it's not White House correspondent. It's not everything serious.
Right. Yes, it's true. But I mean, I think that there are just two sides to me that are both important to me. And I mean, look, I guess if things had worked out differently, is it possible that on Earth 2, I'm a novelist or a cartoonist and I just happen to be like super well informed about the news? Yes. That's possible. First of all, I didn't become a successful novelist until I was 49. So it's also possible that maybe if I had started doing that, maybe, look, I wrote a novel in my 20s and it was not, it was never published. I mean, I submitted it. So maybe the kind of, maybe I wasn't any good at fiction until I had worked in the world of nonfiction for decades and decades. That's certainly possible too. I don't even know where that novel is because the stupid computer people keep changing the formats by which we store things. I think it's on a floppy disk somewhere. I wouldn't even know what to do with it if I found it. But yeah, I mean, but I have to say, Dan, like I'm pretty happy, you know,
Jake, I'm sorry to make, I am sorry to be a limiting you and making it seem like you're actually a failure. I'm not suggesting you seem,
no, no, no,
you
but
seem
I don't
remarkably
want, I don't
well-rounded.
Want you to, I don't want you to worry about me is my point. Like, I feel like I want you to know that I feel like really fortunate that I get to do both.
I don't know how you have the bandwidth to do both is what I'm saying. Like to me, I've always seen that you got to sort of choose that. How many other people have you known who get to do both?
Well, the late, great Jim Lehrer used to write novels also, and he wrote a lot. So he did it. Lawrence O'Donnell, in addition to doing his cable news show on MSNBC, he's done a lot of creative stuff. I think he did a lot of stuff on the West Wing. He was, a consulting producer for the West Wing. So there are a few of us. It's true that it's not a tremendous number of people who have tried it. But, you know, there have been senators. I mean, Bill Cohen and Gary Hart used to write novels together. I mean, like, there are folks out there who, and to be honest, I haven't read any of the Hart Cohen novels. I imagine they're good, but I have no idea. But there are a few people that try to do both, and it doesn't always succeed. And you're right though, that it is something of a conundrum. But I find it completely different though. I mean, it's not like a version of what I do during the day. It is entirely separate. If I hit like a wall, I can just make it up. You know, that's always, you know, I don't have to subscribe to the restraints of the nonfiction world. But B, the more difficult part of it is, you know, if you're writing a nonfiction book or covering nonfiction during the day, it's just the facts are all there and you just decide how to present them to the audience so they understand them. But fiction, you have to invent it. So it's more challenging in that way. But really, honestly, it's just fun. I just find it fun. Are you a big consumer of fiction? Do you read a lot of books?
The reason that I do read, I'm not, I don't love fiction. I'm more nonfiction. But one of the things, the writing process for me is not a fun one. I'd like a better relationship with writing than the one I have. I find it fulfilling, but it's not something, because I know how hard it is, because I know how hard it is to do well, I don't experience it the way that you're experiencing it, which is, let me get to this escape that's vastly different from where I spend the rest of my life. This is something that's going to be fun that I'm going to enjoy doing. I don't know. Most of the writers I've met actually have a complicated relationship with the process of writing.
Oh, don't get me wrong. It's a bear. I mean, like it's challenging. I find, and I don't know how your process works, but I find for me that an outline is really just a treasure map. It's just, this is how you get to where you want to go. So I will spend months and months and months writing an outline. Chapter one, these five things happen. Chapter two, these five things happen, and working on that. And then once that outline is done and I've shown it to people and gotten feedback, then I just break that off into chapters and then I just dive in and like, okay, here's what I need to write today. I find that really helps. I heard George R.R. Martin, the Game of Thrones dude, say that there are two kinds of writers, architects and gardeners. And I'm definitely an architect. I'm definitely like, here is the foundation. Let us write around this.
My team is one win away, and I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to do to celebrate once they get past this series. I'm going to go to my fridge, and I'm going to get myself an ice-cold can of Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and it still hasn't been settled. You see, Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that tastes like beer, less filling and only 96 calories. The original light beer since 1975. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right at your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach, B-E-A-C-H. Or you can get it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
What do you love about news?
I love trying to understand what's going on and trying to explain it to people in a way that is fair and honest and no bullshit. I just think that that is something that I enjoy doing. I also really love telling people, like, this is what's really going on. You know, you might be hearing this, but let's just cut to the chase. This is what actually is the situation with what's going on. And I mean, part of that is probably rooted in, you know, the just who I have always been and, you know, wanting to know more than anybody else knows, wanting to hear what's going on with everybody's lives, I also really enjoy explaining things to people in a way that they can understand. My daughter had a presentation to make for her English class. She was explaining a book that she had read over the summer, and she had to do a presentation. It was a great joy for me because it was one of the few things I could help her with, because she's in ninth grade now, so she has long since passed my understanding of basic math or science. Like, I don't even know what the hell my sixth grader is doing with math.
They do it differently. I've heard this complaint from so many parents that you basically don't know how to correctly teach fourth and fifth. And you're writing novels. You're a White House correspondent. You come from a past that you're a newsman and you don't know how to teach fifth grade math.
I have no idea what's going on that page. None. It's very challenging, but I could explain to her how to do a good presentation, or this is how I would recommend your presentation. You know, what's the number one, what's the world you're in? Number two, who's the main character? Number three, what are the tensions in her life? And then number four, like, how do you feel about what you read? And that was a great joy to me, because there's so much bad communication in this world on the basic human level, and then obviously by politicians and the media and others. And that was a great joy to me because it was something that I felt like I understood. So that's part of it, I think, helping people understand, because I know the joy of not understanding something and then understanding it. That's, you know, like discovering a sunrise or something.
How dismayed have you been by the idea? You grew up, I assume, seeing the evolution of news over the decades, that Donald Trump specifically, that person, yeah, that someone with that lack of subtlety could take such a hatchet by just shouting fake news again and again at news, at credibility, at what you do and what you care about in that explanation.
It was upsetting, but not because he was just seeking to discredit his perceived enemies, whether in the news media or in Congress or in the Republican Party or the judiciary or whatever. It was upsetting because he made facts and decency partisan tools. He made them weapons so that anytime you would report on something he did not like, he would just lie about it. And the idea that we are now in a society where there is not a respect for empirical truth, for fact, which didn't start with Donald Trump, but certainly he embraced and exacerbated. I mean, that's troubling, not for me personally, it's troubling for American society. I mean, if you look at the fact that we're still losing more than 1,000 people a day to COVID, we've lost, I think, more than 200,000 since the vaccines became accessible. That's misinformation. That's disinformation. That's people trying to exploit ignorance for personal gain or for power, or for clicks or for ratings or for whatever. And whether you see this in the lie about the election, or you see it in the lie about the vaccine or masks or whatever, I mean, it has a real corrosive effect. And again, and these, you know, there's nothing conservative about dying of COVID. There's nothing conservative about not believing in democracy. Those aren't conservative principles, but they are these bizarre ones that are in the world now that really have nothing to do with my personal feelings or my, you know, being hurt about something. It's just tremendously damaging. And we just see this insane other world out there of people just believing lies. I mean, I'm fully vaccinated. My wife is fully vaccinated. Our 14-year-old is fully vaccinated. My son just turned 12. He got his first shot Monday. I mean, why would I lie about this?
I'm curious how you feel about the distaste that people have for the media. If I'd come to you 5 years ago and said, this is a lane for the president of the United States to run on a platform of, you hate the media so much that I'm going to give voice to that, and you're going to elect me, at least in part, because you trust the media less than you trust me. What would your assessment have been 5 or 6 years ago of that?
I wouldn't have been surprised, because I know that, you know, Nixon did that to a degree. And I mean, I remember George H.W. Bush I forget if it was 88 or 92, but George H.W. Bush holding a bumper sticker. I have some vague memory of him holding a bumper sticker that said, annoy the media, vote for Bush. So, look, I mean, I understand why some people distrust the media, and I don't think it's getting any better in this era where some journalists, and I'm not going to name names or outlets, but some journalists adhere to a certain ideological allegiance, if not a partisan allegiance, more so than an allegiance to fact and truth. And it bothers me when I see that, because I know that will hurt people's belief in the news media in general. So I think that Trump exploited a fissure that pre-existed, and I think he made it worse. But I also think that there are journalists out there on the left and the right who are also making it worse. You know, during the exit from Afghanistan, I saw journalists leaping to Biden's defense on social media. And I just can't even relate. I mean, I could understand wanting things to be put in context, and, you know, Trump negotiated with the Taliban in 2000 and, you know, and all that. I mean, that's all important, but, you know, there are certain folks that it feels like they care more about defending Democratic politicians than they do about just like being journalists. And I, you know, I don't understand it, and it bothers me. So I think Trump is a tremendous offender when it comes to this. But I also think there are some people in the media that make it worse.
When you say bothers you, how do you feel? Are you allowed to say how you feel about Fox News, Tucker Carlson, some of this stuff that is so polarizing now that it is alternate set of facts, can't agree on anything, can't agree, everything must be an argument that's politicized?
I'm reluctant to target any specific network or anchor, because then things just become about cable wars, and this person sniping about that person, and that person sniping about this person, and the point I'm trying to make gets lost amidst personality battles that I'm not particularly interested in having, because I think that these issues are far larger than me versus, you know, whoever. But I will say that you can do anything you want when you have an anchor chair. You can report on Yemen and have a panel that consists of Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives. You can bring awareness to issues that hurt the disadvantaged among us. Or you can see opportunities for ratings by mining hate or offering, you know, or pushing lies. And I know that I don't do the latter, I do the former. And it's disappointing when I see the latter. I mean, it, you know, in addition to the fact that most Republicans, according to polls, wrongly believe that the last election was stolen, which it was not, there are people who are dead because they listen to disinformation about vaccines and masks. And I just can't, I don't understand how the people who put that information, I don't understand how they sleep at night. I really don't.
How did we get here?
One of the ways we got here is that we have a system that in many ways depends upon an honor code. The American system of government has guardrails, but to a degree, the reason why there isn't necessarily an explicit law that you cannot shake down a foreign government for damaging opposition research against your political opponent. I mean, you can make an argument that that's something of worth and that violates election law, but there's no explicit law that says that what Trump did with Ukraine was against the law. The reason that it doesn't exist is because a failure of the imagination of lawmakers, in the same way that this nation failed to protect the government failed to protect its citizens on 9/11. But beyond that is just because there's a certain honor system, just an honor code. Same thing with news media, which is, with the exception of NPR and PBS, entirely based on a capitalistic system of advertising and subscriptions. And so there always was just an honor code. You know, we're not going to, and this, by the way, applies to things that news outlets do that are beyond politics. Put aside politics for a second. You could have an evening news broadcast that relies on, like, you know, 10 minutes of teases and stories that have great video but aren't necessarily relevant to what's important in the world, and get really good ratings for, like, an evening news network broadcast. But people didn't do it because it just wasn't news. But then, you know, you can't rely on an honor system in a situation where so many people don't have any honor. You can't embarrass the shameless. And we have an incentive structure in this country right now in news media and in politics and in all sorts of places in which the incentives are for all the wrong things. They're for success in terms of clicks and downloads and links and ratings and all that, but there's almost like no moral code to it. And I'm not advocating for one. I think that I'm not advocating for the government to offer one, because I think that would be fraught with problems. But there's just no shame. So I don't know. But that's the best I can come up with when it comes to how did we get here. There's also gerrymandering is a serious problem in this country. You know, I think there was something like, Jerry Seib had a good piece about this in the Wall Street Journal, I think today, about, you know, like 10 or 20 years ago, there were 140 competitive House seats, and now it's like 60. And that means that there's no incentive for people to try to compromise. Congresswoman Jayapal, who I'm not trying to criticize her in any way, but she's the chair of the Progressive Caucus. And I believe her congressional seat in Washington State, which is basically Seattle, I believe it voted for Biden like by 36 percentage points. Well, where's the incentive structure? Again, Congressman, this is not meant as an insult of Congressman Jayapal or how she does her business, but in a congressional seat that you have, you can be reelected, and there is very little incentive to work with a Republican or even a moderate Democrat how does that help anything? So, I mean, I do think gerrymandering is part of the problem. That's a bad example because Jayapal, I think, is willing to make a deal, but on a number of issues. But you see that on the left, you see it on the right. I think that's also a problem.
You've got to get out of here, unfortunately, to do your own things. But The Devil May Dance is available now. I have a bunch more questions, but what do you want?
You can ask them. I can take a few more minutes.
All right. What do you view as the greatest threat to democracy right now?
Right now, the greatest threat to the democracy is the big lie that Donald Trump perpetrated, and his legitimate attempt to overthrow the election. And the fact that so many Republican office holders, I think most of whom know better, went all in on it because they're afraid. They're afraid of Donald Trump, and they're not just afraid of their careers, although that is part of it. They are also legitimately afraid of death threats. And I know this because I'm working on a documentary about the election, and I know from talking to people, like, this is serious. This is serious stuff. And if we saw it in a different country, if we saw it in Mexico, if we saw it in Germany, we would be sounding the alarm about the threat to democracy in Mexico and Germany. But it's happening here, and we're kind of sanguine to it and about it. And also, there's an entire media network of not all conservative media, but a great deal of conservative media that is part of the problem with it, that is fueling the lies, or at least mainstreaming them. And beyond that, there is a part of the mainstream media that seems to want to just kind of move on and go back to like the world of like Paul Ryan versus Barack Obama or whatever, when that's not the world we're in. We're not debating Medicare cuts. We're talking about democracy. There was this memo by this lawyer, Eastman, basically how to coup, right? It was his argument as to how Pence could, as leading the proceedings on January 6th, how Pence could basically overturn the election. I read somewhere that it wasn't even covered by ABC, NBC, or CBS during the week, which I found shocking. I think we all need to wake up here because, look, I don't care if the next president's a Republican or Mitch McConnell becomes the Senate Majority Leader or the Republicans take the House, as long as it's done in a free and fair way. But that's really, I mean, just listen to what Liz Cheney is saying, and she's no liberal. We're really under threat here. So, I mean, I think it's the forces of Trumpism that are the threat, but it's also the news media that really needs to be sounding the alarm here in a major way.
Are you scared? Because I'm surprised the news media isn't sounding the alarm in a major way on something that would seem to be the biggest news story of our lifetimes, which is we're destroying the world and it's apocalyptic and things are coming our way that scientists and the UN and conservative organizations are saying code red, we're talking about the end of humanity and breathable air.
Yeah. Well, yes, I am very worried about climate change, the climate crisis, and we cover it a great deal on my show. And I do think that that's going to be something else that our kids, I have a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old, and that our kids come to us and say, why didn't you cover this more? You know, we have a segment on my show called Earth Matters, where we cover this several times a week, and we'll continue to. But yeah, no, I'm terrified about the climate crisis. I mean, I think that's a real problem, and it's also something that if we don't take it seriously, I can't even imagine. I mean, we see the results of it. Like, we feel like we've hit a tipping point where now we regularly see the results of it in Florida and on the Pacific Coast, and it's terrifying.
Your book, and I don't want to get you out of here, but I do want to talk about your book, and hopefully we can have a conversation another time more about some other things. The Devil May Dance, though, what do you want? It's available now. What do you want people to know about it?
Oh, I think that people should know that it is, I hope, a fun read. Charlie and Margaret are my heroes. Charlie is a congressman, and Margaret is his zoologist wife, and I hope people like them as a couple. And the book takes place in 1962 in Los Angeles. Hollywood. Charlie and Margaret basically get blackmailed by Attorney General Robert Kennedy to go out and find out if Frank Sinatra, is actually mobbed up, or if it's just kind of like tough guy fronting, just pretending he is. And this is based on a true story. The true story being that Sinatra, because he helped get John F. Kennedy elected president with the Rat Pack, thought that Kennedy would come out as president and stay with him in his Rancho Mirage estate in 1962. And he started having all this work done to his estate. He had a helipad installed and extra rooms and phone lines put in, preparing for this presidential visit. Again, this is all real. And then Attorney General Kennedy, who was going after organized crime at the Justice Department, somebody pointed out to him, you know, it's kind of awkward. You're going after mobsters, and your brother's friends, Sinatra, is like, he's friends with a bunch of these guys, like Sam Giancana out of Chicago, or Handsome Johnny Roselli out of LA. And so Bobby Kennedy had a choice before him. Do I cancel this trip or cancel this stay at Sinatra's and offend one of my brother's biggest, most famous, most powerful friends? Or do I have my brother sleep in a bed that mobsters slept in? So that's the real story that inspired the book, and hopefully people will find it fun. I mean, that's why I wrote it, and that's what I hope people get out of it. I hope they just find it like a fun yarn full of Hollywood intrigue and Rat Pack cigar smoke and bourbon.
You enjoyed saying Handsome Johnny's name. You really
Handsome
did.
Johnny Roselli?
Yeah, you enjoyed it. Yeah. I know, but you enjoyed the whole thing is built around whatever it is that Handsome Johnny Roselli represent.
Well, you know, my mom grew up in my mom lives in right on the border of South Philadelphia, so I grew up with people with names like little Nicky Scarfo and names like that I enjoyed saying at the time. And I remember when Angelo Bruno got whacked. I mean, this part, not really part of my life, but part of the newspaper headlines when I was growing up, the mob wars in Philly in the 70s and 80s.
I did not expect this to end with the sentence, "I remember when Angelo Bruno got whacked." Thank you, Jake, for being on with us. I appreciate it.
It was really fun. Let me know if you want to talk again. I'd love to do it.
Our thanks to Jake Tapper. He rode that like a surfboard, like a beautiful wave. My assholery. Our thanks to Jake Tapper for tolerating my nonsense. A reminder to support the Lebatard and Friends Network. Mystery Crate always has some surprises for you. Stupidity is getting stronger and stronger now that Billy Gill has grabbed the steering wheel and is helping everybody stay within the guardrails. And this is South Beach Sessions. We ask you please to support these things so we can keep making them and more. We'll talk to you again next week.
My team is one win away, and I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to do to celebrate once they get past this series. I'm going to go to my fridge, and I'm going to get myself an ice-cold can of Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and it still hasn't been settled. You see, Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that tastes like beer, less filling and only 96 calories. The original light beer since 1975. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right at your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach, BEACH. Or you can get it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.